to try to come up with a plan and get you and it off the planet, Abia said. When Carolyn shot him a savage look, he pressed on. My people owe them too much for me to walk away. Come to think of it, it's our people that owe them. I'm not starting that conversation again, she said dismissively. Let us see what we can come up with. Fair warning, I'm not putting my new ship or life at risk for whatever the hell it is you're doing with this thing. I suppose that will have to do for now, Twingo said, before Cage could open his mouth and ruin the negotiations. For whatever reason, Carolyn absolutely couldn't stand the little Viren. We'd better start filing out of here and lock the place back up. You won't kill us! I've run into you guys before. Your honor code, your rules of engagement, you'll just beat on us some more, but in the end, you'll pull up short before... The rant was cut short by the deafening report of a high-power plasma pistol discharging within an enclosed space. Once Tuval's eyes cleared, he saw that his brother, who had been tied to the chair next to him, now had a smoking crater where his face had once been. You were saying? Jason asked.
You killed my packmate!
You'll start talking, or that's happening to you next, Crusher rumbled from behind him. And if we do that, we'll have to go pull a few more out of your family den and start this whole process over. That's going to piss me off. A lot. In other words, we won't be as nice the next time around, Jason said. You were sent to intimidate and damage property along the riverfront. I want to know why, and I also want to know where you've been getting military-grade weaponry. He's stalling, Crusher said, wrapping a massive hand over the squirming alien's throat. I told you we caught this pair too easily. Talk or die, Jason said flatly.
The job is you, Tuval gasped. We came to the world and baited you into coming after us.
Why?
The money!
Have we checked the bounty boards in a while? Jason asked. Last I saw it was only a few grand. That's hardly worth the risk of coming after us.
It's millions! Please, I can't breathe!
You're sure doing a lot of talking for not being able to breathe. Crusher never let up his grip. Millions? Who would pay millions for us? We haven't killed that many by accident. Or on purpose.
It's...
Let up a bit, Crusher, Jason said.
An aggregate contract. 9 buyers. We get 11 million credits if we bring your bodies in.
Tuval rubbed at his throat, glaring at Jason. Damn, Jason sighed. These two were supposed to get caught. I'm sure one has a tracker stuck up in him somewhere. Crusher pulled a long, curved blade out and grinned savagely. Tuval went from his normal bright pink to yellow and vomited onto his chest at the sight of a galvetic warrior advancing on him, intent on looking through his insides to find the device. It's too late for that, Jason waved him off, hefting his favorite primary weapon. The railgun was a nasty bit of work that, despite being attached to his infamy, still seemed to surprise people with its sheer destructive power. Better grab your toys and get ready. They'll be coming. Jason deployed the helmet on his last remaining powered armor suit. This one, a medium-duty unit that could take a decent amount of punishment and afforded increased mobility. His heavy suit had been destroyed in the same mission that... Best not to begin dwelling on that again. It never led any place good.
Should we just kill this vermin and then try to get to the ship? Crusher asked.
Huh? Oh, yeah, I don't give a shit either way, Jason said as he checked over his armament. He'd actually been joking just to screw with Tuval, but apparently Crusher had been sincere with the question. The alien, Jason had never actually learned what species the family unit was from, screamed and pleaded for his life before a wet snap ended it. Jason looked over and saw Tuval's head flopped over at an unnatural angle and just shook his head at Crusher.
What? You said you didn't care.
I'm not mad, I'm just disappointed, Jason said. Restraint is the only thing that separates us from the animals,
says the guy that locked two Rienlur in an unpressurized cargo pod on a ship that was about to launch, Crusher snorted.
That was an accident. Jason looked away, his lofty expression hidden by the death's head visage of his helmet.
Whatever. These were legal kills. The province hired us to root them out using any means necessary. So, what are we thinking? Crusher was cut off by a stout explosion that blew the door of the office building they'd commandeered out of its frame. It was a breaching charge, so there wasn't much fire or smoke, but it still created an overpressure in the room that caused everyone not wearing armor to drop to their knees in pain. Jason wheeled and opened fire just as the first of Tuval's relatives came pouring in. He'd had the railgun in low velocity mode, so he was able to lay down sustained, suppressive fire for the split second it took Crusher to shake off the effects of the concussive blast and get into the fight. The big warrior plucked a grenade from his harness and eased around while Jason kept them pinned, tossing the charge out the doorway with a negligent lob. The munition had been set with a short fuse, and it exploded before it even hit the ground.
"Cease fire!"
Crusher yelled, waving Jason off. The human swapped in a fresh magazine and cycled the weapon, checking that the cooling system was bringing the rail temperatures back down after the abuse.
"Six tangos down. None within sight."
"That means we're missing three, counting the two dead in here," Jason said. "I'm going up top to look for a spotter. Don't silhouette yourself in the doorway until I clear it."
"I've done this before," Crusher snapped.
Jason ignored him and went back into a supply closet where a rickety ladder led up to an access door. The lock looked flimsy as hell, so he curled his gauntlet into a fist and punched directly at it, the force amplified by the armor's actuators. As expected, the lock exploded. The door flew up and ripped off its hinges, tumbling through the air and landing on the roof with a thud.
"There!"
Before Jason could even get his head and shoulders up through the opening, two more of their attackers turned from where they were perched at the edge. They were apparently waiting for them to exit so they could shoot them from above. The one who had spotted him threw a cylindrical object at him, and he batted it away instinctively, turning his head just as it exploded and peppered his armor with debris and shrapnel. The grenade was a small anti-personal type, and he'd flung it up and away, but it still had enough punch that when he looked again, the idiot that threw it was on the ground, writhing in pain. His partner was nowhere to be found, but a smoking boot left on the edge of the roof told the tale.
"Good plan," Jason said, walking up and looking down at the gravely wounded alien. "Who's your handler? What are the contract details?"
Before he could get an answer, Jason's display washed out, and thermal shock alarms started blaring while his HUD lit up with warnings. He ducked and rolled to the edge of the roof, behind the short wall, his armor smoking and hissing where a plasma bolt had hit him from well outside the optimal range. Had it been a closer shot, he may not have been so lucky. Taking a quick breath, he popped his head up for a split second and ducked back down just as another shot roared over his head. From the dispersal of the shot and the way the plasma was streaming behind it, he guessed the range was close to 200 meters. Wrong weapon for that sort of work. He flicked his railgun's selector to high velocity and grinned behind his mask. He not only had a range, but his armor's combat computer had registered from where the shot had come and was feeding him directional data.
"We have one left, Crusher," he said over the comm. "Stand by."
"Copy."
Jason crawled along the short retainer wall so he wouldn't appear in the same spot, verified the target's position from the last known shot, and rolled smoothly up into his stance. The optics on his weapon picked out the movement on a building 228 meters away and automatically adjusted his point of aim. He squeezed off two hypersonic rounds and watched as the ledge his target was kneeling on exploded. Jason could tell he hadn't actually hit the target since it was intact as it fell, but the fall from seven stories up should do the trick.
"Target down, not confirmed dead," he reported. "Southeast from here."
"I've got it," Crusher grumbled. "I'll just go over to where you shot half that building down with that ridiculous gun."
When he turned back to the fallen alien on the roof with him, he was dismayed to see that he had died. Jason went through his pockets, looking for anything that would give them details on who was posting up such large bounties on them. Nothing. He walked over to the edge of the two-story roof he was on and hopped off, his sabatons smashing into the street and breaking the pavement. He jogged over to where Crusher was examining the badly mangled body of the spotter.
It appeared that some of the ledge had broken off after he fell and then landed on him.
This is fucking gross, Crusher complained. Why can't you just burn people down with a plasma weapon, like a civilized being?
It's not my fault part of the building squished him. Jason retracted his helmet and looked at the mess. Find anything?
This guy was probably in charge. He has some specialized comm gear, and he was the only one carrying a comm unit.
Which would be great if we had a cold slicer to get into it, Jason sighed. Let's just get back to the Phoenix. We'll call for payment once we're off-world, and we'll see if the computer can do anything with that.
Do you remember where you parked this time? Crusher asked, as they moved off, wanting to be well gone before people became brave enough to come out and see what all the noise was about.
One damn time, I lost a ship, and I never hear the end of it, Jason griped. If you hadn't broken my comm unit, it wouldn't have been an issue.
I hadn't noticed how shifty you were until the others weren't around. Do you ever take responsibility for your screw-ups?
Nope. An insistent beeping from his comm unit cut off the argument.
Huh.
The Phoenix just received a message from Carol and Whitney. It's flagged as urgent.
Now, there's a ruthless human, Crusher said, with a short, barking laugh.
I like her.
You would.
More than I like you, anyway.
Got it.
Chapter 5
It's been damn near 3 weeks, Twinko fumed. We can't just sit here forever.
I'm not sure Carolyn is wrong, Cage said. Twinko, there was a lot of heat, and we're in possession of something that could get us executed if we're caught. I'm anxious too, but honestly, maybe we should have taken it even further.
You lost me.
Maybe we should have hidden the body on this planet and then left. Cage said. Tala said Lucky's core systems are safe in stasis for an almost indefinite amount of time. Even if we came back a year or two later, it would be better than being caught with that thing.
Mach did haul ass out of here when things got too hot, didn't he?
Twinko was somewhat mollified.
Maybe he was the smarter one.
Yeah, about that. You don't think he set us up, do you? Cage asked. He did flee right after we stashed the body. If that other team was his, that means he has Lucky, our only battle synth expert, and the other body that was taken.
Wow! Thanks for adding that to my pile of things to worry about, Twinko snapped, still pacing. But no, I don't think he screwed us, as Jason would say. It does him no good. If Tallis was able to perform the integration alone, it's not like Lucky would wake up and suddenly be Mach's slave. What probably... You okay?
Yeah, Cage waved him off. I've been passing the time by trying to recompile and decrypt the data I took from that lab. It's taking a bit more out of me than I thought.
The pair fell silent, each lost in their own thoughts. Days had stretched into weeks as they waited for some word from the Viper about an extraction plan, as well as staying glued to the local media to see what developments there might be on the explosion that took out the lab and most of the city block it sat on. The fact things were largely silent about so much destruction in a normally quiet city spoke volumes. Powerful people were interested in making sure this wasn't too widely known. It wasn't that the pair was wavering in their commitment. They'd come too far and done too much to turn back now. The issue was what it was costing each of them personally. Twinko, especially, had tried to stay above the fray when Omega Force dabbled in gross criminal conduct, but this mission to try and save his friend had led him to crossing so many lines that he'd stopped counting the number of local and confed laws he'd been breaking. By actually capturing one of the prototype battle synth bodies, they'd achieved a level of success that he secretly thought they never would. Now the consequences would go far beyond what would have been a slap on the wrist for some harmless criminal mischief and a few assaults. Then he remembered who his friend had actually been. Whenever Twinko started feeling sorry for himself, he remembered that Lucky had grabbed a bomb and detonated it against his body to save Jason's life, and that Jason had fought so hard to not let him do it that he'd almost killed himself. Their commitment to each other and to the team was absolute. Twingo wouldn't dishonor them by being any less. The door chimed to their rented rooms caused Twingo to nearly jump out of his own skin. Cage was so immersed in what he was doing inside his head that his eyes barely fluttered.
"Start backing yourself out of whatever you're doing," Twingo told him. "I think this may be go time."
"You are correct," Carolyn said when he answered the door. "It's go time." Twingo hid how startled he was that she could hear him through the insulated door. He always forgot that Viper was extensively modified with all kinds of bionic upgrades that allowed her to perform her function as an assassin and spy. Jason was unbelievably strong and resilient thanks to Doc's genetic tinkering, but for the most part, he was still just a human. Carolyn was more of a machine with a human brain driving it.
"What's the plan?" Cage asked,
disconnecting the hard lines from his neural interface and standing up.
"We have transport coming in tonight to get you and it off-planet," she said. "No real details other than you need to be there before they show up." "And what's your role in this plan?" Twingo asked.
He was now completely suspicious of the human standing before him. They'd moved the body 3 times now on the planet at her direction, and he wasn't above thinking she'd sold them out to the authorities for a reward.
"Not much," Carolyn said evasively. "Abia and I will provide overwatch, keep you in the loop about movement around the building, and then once you're on your way, we'll sneak off and fly out ourselves. This way, neither of us is connected to the other."
"I'm overwhelmed by your concern," Cage said.
"It is what it is," she shrugged. "I'm a mercenary. You're lucky I came here at all. I want no part of whatever you're into that's making you steal top-secret Keprian military hardware, and I couldn't care less about the internal squabbles of your little band of pirates and thieves. My interest at this point is to leave here unnoticed and fly as far away from you as possible. I've never seen such a small group create so much chaos wherever they go."
"Thank you."
Wasn't a compliment.
"It's all prepped to move," Twingo said quietly, closing the lid on the shielded coffin he and Cage had cobbled together using scraps from around the city.
Theoretically, the box would thwart casual security scans and allow them to move the body up out of the sub-basement of the engine overhaul facility they'd stashed it in. The place saw little traffic as it only worked on intra-atmospheric engines for the local cargo shuttles. It wasn't that there weren't that many shuttles, it was more that the engines used were so reliable there wasn't a need for a heavily staffed shop. The old-timer that ran the place had rented them the space they needed, accepting cash after Twingo had talked him up about his longing for the old plasma turbines that had been popular for a time on Confed Worlds.
"You seem like nice enough youngsters," had been his response, as he pocketed the credit chits.
"Let's get it up on the main floor and then wait for our ride," Cage said. "You think it's Mach coming back to get us?"
"Hard to say," Twingo said. "It would make sense, but if it is, there are ways he could have gotten a hold of us directly. I checked all of our dead drop accounts. Nothing. It's like he's dropped through a wormhole without a trace."
They grunted and swore as they maneuvered the clunky coffin into the freight lift and started up towards the main floor. The shop was along the perimeter of what had once been a bustling spaceport, but once the newer facility opened to the south, the only thing left on the complex were the local scrap haulers and a burgeoning package delivery service that advertised it had a way of smoothing out pesky import control issues. What that meant was that there were 14 square kilometers of tarmac that was barely used, and the duracrete was too dense for the weather to wear down or the plant life to break through. Twingo thought there was something decidedly eerie about an abandoned spaceport. It was like standing in the middle of a tarmac desert.
"Guys, you have incoming," Carolyn's voice came over the comm. 3 unidentified craft are converging on your location fast. None of them appear to be your ride out of there. I'd advise you to go back down into the sub-basement."
"Why bother?" Cage asked on the open channel. "They know we're here."
In less than a minute, Cage and Twingo, still standing on either side of the improvised coffin, were bathed in a harsh light as 3 shuttles settled into a hover and arrayed themselves in front of the shop's main doors. Twingo just sighed, certain that it was the authorities and that they'd been tracked the whole time. Cage's jaw jutted out defiantly, and he glared up at the hovering ships, making rude gestures with his two smaller arms. Twingo almost laughed aloud at the little Viren, but something began to tickle at his ears. Something familiar. The sound grew into a dull rumble that Cage now noticed as well. He frowned and looked at Twingo. Before they could confer, the lead shuttle exploded in a magnificent fireball, the concussion knocking them flat on their backs. When Twingo sat up, shaking his head to clear it, he saw something shoot overhead. Another shuttle exploded, and the ground shook from four massive plasma thrust engines. The Phoenix had arrived. His eyes welled up, and his chest was tight with conflicting emotions as he saw the ship, his ship, wheel about and come hard at the remaining shuttle, the punishing roar of her engines making breathing damn near impossible. The third shuttle turned and zipped away to the north in the opposite direction of the big gunship, but Jason wasn't having it. The Phoenix bellowed like an enraged animal as she tore off into the night after it, the sound of the engines still hammering at them even after she was well out of sight. "Splash three," Carolyn said calmly. "I believe you can handle things from here."
"Oh yeah, I'm gonna handle the shit out of this," Jason's voice broke in on the channel. He didn't sound all that happy.
"We're out then," the Viper said. "You owe me."
Still lying on his back, Twingo looked up as the Phoenix rumbled over the building, dropping her landing gear and settling onto the tarmac with a slight bounce. Twingo could see that she was in pretty rough shape, but when he saw the angry set to Jason's jaw as he came stomping down the ramp, he decided now wasn't the time to make an issue of the ship's mistreatment.
"What the hell is going on here?" Jason shouted at them when he was within earshot. "I don't hear from you for months, and then I get a call from Whitney, of all people, saying you're in deep shit, and you're working with Mach on something?"
"No time," Cage shouted, grabbing the cart with the coffin on it. "We need to get the hell out of here while the getting is good."
Jason narrowed his eyes and looked as if he wanted to argue the point further, but instead he jerked his head in the direction of the cargo bay and let the pair struggle past with their load without further comment or offer to help. By the time the local first responders made it to the scene, the Phoenix was long gone, flying south below the sensor grids over the large stretches of uninhabited swampland, before nosing up over the equator and pushing to orbit. The forged credentials and clean transponder codes they were flying made it fairly easy to get off the sleepy planet, the orbital control authorities apparently having little to no contact with the people on the ground. Jason sat silently in the pilot's seat, still seething. Twingo knew his human friend could be touchy, and his temper was somewhat unpredictable, but the radiating waves of anger coming off the man surprised and scared him. Jason and Crusher had decided on their own to fly off and indulge themselves by giving in to their baser instincts and violent tendencies. So why should he be this angry because he and Cage had also found something to occupy their time? If he was pissed because they'd been cavorting about with Sedativa Mach, then he was going to go ballistic when he found out what was sitting in the cargo hold and why.
Is that what I think it is? Crusher asked.
Jason stood there, staring down into the makeshift shipping container, his face an unreadable mask.
If you think it's a prototype second-generation battle synth body, then yes, it is what you think it is, Cage answered.
It's just a body? It hasn't been integrated with a processing matrix? Jason asked.
Nope, just a body.
So why do you have it? Jason pressed. Putting aside the fact that its very existence is highly, highly illegal, why are you two dipshits working with gangsters and assassins to steal a body you have no use for?
Well, there is one other thing, Twingo said, now treading very carefully and choosing his next words precisely.
Well? Jason demanded.
His posture had shifted, and Twingo knew he was on dangerous ground. As per usual, Cage decided this would be a good time to be helpful.
Part of Lucky was found during the post-battle assessment Mach's people did on Kepri. Tallis thinks his primary matrix is still intact. So we've been hunting around for this rumored lab to steal a body and try to reintegrate.
That was as far as he got, because Jason palmed the little Viren's head and slammed it down onto the crate, holding it there.
Use your words,
Cage managed to squeeze out from where Jason had his face squished into the metal.
What the hell did you just say? You're telling me Lucky has been alive this whole time and I'm just now finding out about it?
Jason's face was a dangerous shade of purple, and a vein was throbbing in his forehead. Twingo knew that thanks to Doc's irresponsible tinkering with the genetic code of a species he was barely familiar with, Jason's adrenal response was unpredictable and dangerous when he became enraged. Apparently, he wasn't the only one who felt that way.
Let him go, Crusher said firmly, his body quartered away from Jason and his right hand on the grip of his sidearm. Now, Jason!
The human eyed the galvanic warrior for a long moment, and Twingo could almost see rationality warring with the anger in his friend before he opened his hand and let Cage slip to the floor, rubbing his face.
Someone had better start talking. And now!
Jason stepped back from the container and crossed his arms over his chest. Over the next 2 hours, Twingo and Cage filled them in on the hunt for a replacement body and the odds that Lucky was still alive somewhere inside the charred and twisted remains that had been found on Kepri. Crusher seemed completely immersed in the story, but Jason still stood there like a statue. Every once in a while he'd look down at the body, but that was it. No questions, no comments, and nothing to indicate he wasn't going to fly off the handle again once they'd wrapped up.
So, Mach has Lucky's remains right now? Jason asked.
Yes.
If you contact him to bring them, and Tallis, back to Satora, would he do it?
I don't see why not, Cage said. I'm not sure why you're so hung up on his involvement. He's been nothing but helpful.
Mach is the kingpin of one of the largest criminal organizations in the Quadrant, Jason said. You'd do well to remember that. There's nothing for free when dealing with these types, and I'm afraid to find out what he'll ask for in return after you run up such a high tab.
Where has Doc been this whole time? Crusher asked.
Back home, Cage answered. You know him, probably sitting around reading and working on some pet project. He's aware of what we're doing, but he decided at the last minute he'd rather not be involved.
Jason just grunted at that and rolled his eyes.
Make the call to Mach, he said. I'm changing course and we're heading home. I almost can't overstate how dangerous it is having this aboard. Did you bother to think about what might happen if you're even successful at this?
What do you mean?
Twingo asked.
Lucky was a recognized sentient species, Jason said. Despite some of the finer details that caused problems, he was more or less free to go where he wanted. Just stuffing his brain into this body doesn't make its existence any less problematic. Hell, for all we know, this will get us into even more trouble since we've taken an inert prototype and integrated it with a battle-hardened matrix.
Ah, Twingo said, turning a bit pale. I see your point. So, do you want me to tell Mach we've had a change of plans?
No, Jason said after a moment. But you may have created bigger problems than we can easily deal with this time. You have no idea who the other group of hitters was that got to the lab before you?
None. All we know is they stole another of the prototypes and then rigged the place to blow. They didn't seem too concerned with leaving us alive when they made their escape since they ran right by Cage's team without so much as a second look.
I wouldn't worry about who they are, Captain. We'll find out soon enough, Crusher said. The Viper was right. They've been tracking these idiots the whole time. I don't think we'll have to wait long before they make another appearance.
Good times, Jason sighed, turning to leave the cargo hold.
Twingo, if you want to make it back to Satora anytime soon, or at all, I'd suggest you get your blue ass into engineering and get the slip drive realigned.
Twingo grumbled at the comment. But he was glad to escape the tension in the cargo hold and get back to the familiar confines of the gunship's engineering bays. He could tell just from the feel through the deck that the ship was not running well, which meant that Jason and Crusher had been abusing the hell out of her without making sure proper maintenance was being done. He couldn't make them understand that the Phoenix, while smaller, had most of the problems the larger starships had when it came to keeping her flying safely. The amount of work he was facing due to their incompetence rankled him, but it still felt good to be home.
Chapter 6. If we leave the Phoenix parked out on the landing pad, we can use the hangar floor as a workspace and have plenty of room, Jason said, his voice echoing off the walls of the cavernous hangar and base of operations they dug back into a mountain on the planet Satora. The only issue I see is we don't have the ability to generate the sort of power you're talking about.
Sure we do, Cage said. We can tap directly into the Phoenix's power mux. She's got an antimatter reactor that's really too big for a ship that size and will easily be able to generate the surge we'll need to activate the battle synth's internal cells.
Twingo? Jason asked.
It shouldn't be an issue, the engineer said. The ship can produce the needed power, and just buying the heavy cables to run in here won't arouse the sort of suspicion a portable fusion generator would. Mox should be here tomorrow with everything we'll need aboard his ship, including Lucky and Tallis.
Is he coming here personally? Jason asked.
That's the impression I got, Twingo said.
Jason said nothing, but his friends could tell that he wasn't pleased about this. Everything Mach did was calculated for his own benefit, but not knowing exactly why the gangster seemed to have such an interest in their small outfit bothered Jason. It defied logic, given that Mach could afford to field a professional military. A small band of mercenaries working jobs along the periphery should have been something well below his notice. This new wrinkle, where Mach had taken such a direct role in trying to help Cage and Twingo resurrect Lucky, just made him more suspicious. What concessions would he try to wring from Jason once it was all over? As it turned out, Mach was wasting no time in getting to them, and his ship hit orbit over Satora in the middle of the night, local time. Jason was roused out of bed and asked to come in and get the Phoenix out of the way so Mach could land his large cargo shuttles on the pad to unload all the equipment he'd brought. Grumbling about the time and the fact that damn near everyone else on the crew was at least capable enough to fly the ship in circles for a few hours, Jason arrived at the hangar, disheveled and in a foul mood. Being mindful of the locals, he slowly eased the Phoenix off the pad and drifted lazily up and away over the sea where he commanded the autopilot to orbit in a loose figure eight while he watched the camera feeds from the hangar. Almost as soon as he'd cleared the area, the first of five medium-duty cargo shuttles touched down, disgorged its payload, and took off again to make room for the next. He leaned forward with interest as Saditava Mach walked from the last shuttle and warmly greeted both Twingo and Cage. Tallis came out next. He was followed by a crew member pushing something Jason recognized from their last mission together. A battle synth long-term stasis pod. That must be what they were keeping Lucky's processor matrix in. Mach looked around the pad as the shuttle lifted off, pointed, and made a comment about Jason's 1967 Camaro convertible that was parked under a storage overhang, and then looked right up into the camera, tossing it a mocking salute.
"Sometimes I really hate that smug son of a bitch," Jason ground out.
The camera that Jason was using to watch the parade of equipment from Mach's ship was carefully hidden within the rock face above the hangar doors. The fact the crime boss had so casually pointed it out and correctly assumed he was monitoring it chafed at his already raw nerves. It was clear that Mach had set his people on gathering intel on Omega Force's base of operations, and he had no issue with letting Jason know it. Maybe Carolyn was right. Maybe putting down roots and making a permanent dirtside home had been a mistake.
"We're all clear, Jason. Bring her back in whenever you're ready,"
Twingo's voice broke in over the comm.
Whenever he was ready. Jason thought that over for a moment, and actually had to fight the impulse to point her nose to the night sky and just leave again. Maybe he'd go to Resteria and see what the Reddix brothers were up to.
Or he could sneak back to Terra Novus and visit Russ Johnson at Earth's new space military training centers. Anything to avoid going back and facing the reality that awaited him in that hangar. While he hadn't really dealt with Lucky's death in a healthy way, he had put it behind him. Now, Twingo and Cage had come along and offered him the cruelest gift of all. Hope.
Hello, Jason. You're looking well.
Mock. Jason nodded politely and surprised everyone, Mock most of all, by offering his hand in greeting.
I'll return to my ship and allow everyone to get back to sleep, Mock said after an uncomfortable pause.
I'll come back in the morning with my technical team and we can begin setting up and we'll leave you to your task.
Thanks, Mock, Twingo said. We'll just wait for them to begin unpacking the crates. Then the real hard work begins.
I can imagine, Mock said smoothly, and, with a final bow, walked back out the yawning hangar doors just as a small orbital jumper dropped to a low hover near the edge of the landing pad and lowered a ramp. Once Mock and his security team were aboard, it zipped off into the night.
What did you mean by real hard work? Jason asked.
This isn't as simple as slapping some connectors together and flipping a switch, Twingo said. Cage downloaded as much of the technical package as he could, but he's still decrypting it. If he wasn't able to get all the specs and procedures that Tallis will need, this will have likely turned out to be a lot of risk for no reward.
I see. Well, standing around worrying about it won't do anything tonight. I'm going to sleep aboard the Phoenix. See you in the morning.
Jason turned and walked back up the ramp of his ship, closing the pressured doors and, on a whim, raised the ramp and locked her up tight. The last thing he saw before the ramp fully closed was the main hangar doors rolling ponderously on their tracks. He walked up to the bridge and activated the ship's external security systems and prepped her for a quick start. It wasn't that he actually expected any trouble or duplicity from Mock at this point, but he was still nervous about having an illegal prototype bit of military hardware sitting on the floor inside the hangar. Satora was a sleepy backwater world, and the coastal towns were even more laid back. It tended to lull one into a false sense of security, and that's when slip-ups happened. In his line of work, a slip-up could very well prove fatal. With one last look around the ship, he made sure his armament was nearby, and then slipped into his rack with his clothes still on. If he was lucky, it would be many hours from now before the ship woke him up, and then only to tell him that breakfast was ready. Jason wasn't lucky. The insistent tug at the back of his mind that was the ship interfacing with his neural implant to wake him up let him know immediately that something was wrong. He tried to activate the external sensor feeds and found that all the imagers were just transmitting nausea-inducing patterns of swirling colors.
What the hell?
He rolled off his rack and slipped on his tactical harness, his sidearms still in their holsters, and plucked the heavy plasma rifle up from where it rested against the bulkhead. While not his weapon of choice, he'd learned the hard way that the collateral damage from his beloved railgun made it not ideal for all situations. Instead of running down into the cargo bay and lowering the ramp, Jason made his way into the starboard engineering bay and commanded one of the dorsal access hatches open after cutting the interior lights. He quickly climbed the ladder and low crawled out onto the top of the Phoenix, where he crouched and listened. The night was dead quiet, but he knew someone was out there and had successfully defeated the gunship's external cameras. Craning his head up to the top of the port vertical stabilizer, where one of the cameras was housed, he saw that something foreign was attached to the transparent bubble. Apparently, whoever was infiltrating their base knew enough about the ship to deploy multispectral noise generators over the imagers, but not enough to be able to climb up on her and internally disable the system. That made Jason feel marginally better, but it did show that whoever was sneaking about was a pro. He walked across the upper hull as quietly as he could, stopping near the port wing route and crouching down, switching his ocular implants to midwave infrared. As soon as he did, two hotspots showed up near the hangar doors that hadn't been there in the visible spectrum,
or at least hadn't been visible in the low light. The figures were draped head to toe in some sort of loose, adaptive camouflage that must have been good enough to spoof the building's camera system, since there were none of the odd covers on the imagers embedded in the mountain. Jason made a mental note to have Twingo upgrade the system to multispectral and moved further down the wing of the gunship to where the tip hung over the parking apron. Below him was a shag pile of large, unforgiving rocks that the mild surf of the bay lapped against to give him a bit of sound cover. Gripping the trailing edge of the wing, Jason carefully slid his body over until he was hanging by his fingertips. He looked down and carefully judged his landing area before letting go, dropping nearly 12 meters and absorbing the impact with his legs. The two rocks he'd picked to land on were some of the few that weren't covered in algae from high tide, and the soft soles of his boots gripped and held. He checked the comm again and found it was still being jammed. Damn, whoever these guys were, they weren't your run-of-the-mill criminals, so that ruled out anybody he and Crusher may have pissed off on the frontier. Before exposing himself, Jason pulled his comm unit and scrolled through a few more functions to see if he could find anything that hadn't been jammed or otherwise defeated. The local networks were locked out on the device altogether, so he went back to pinging the Phoenix with his neural implants. Ah, there it was. While the ship's normal surveillance imagers were all blocked, all the targeting sensors were still retracted and unexposed. He worked through all the mental syntax commands trying to find some combination that would allow him to deploy the targeting imagers when he finally gave up and told the ship to deploy weapons. The command would automatically activate all targeting and defensive sensors, but it would be noisy. The clanks of the rear cannons deploying from near the ramp were Jason's cue to climb the hill and see who had been poking around his hangar. The first thing he saw was that the bastards had managed to open up a decent-sized hole in the door without making a sound. Impressive. They were looking at the now active gunship and arraying themselves into a defensive position.
"In for a buck, or however the hell that saying goes," Jason muttered,
and brought the big plasma rifle up and sighted on the nearest target. He squeezed off a sustained burst that launched the bipedal being off its feet and sent it skidding across the tarmac. Jason's brain registered two facts, even as the second target turned towards him. That plasma burst should have incinerated a biological being, not sent it flying. The second fact was the target made a distinctly metallic clatter as it skidded over to where the Camaro was parked. Even before the second assailant threw off its camo shroud, he knew what he was dealing with. Battle synths.
"Should have brought the damn railgun," he muttered,
holding down the trigger and hammering the one still standing even as the other leapt to its feet and switched over to combat mode. Glowing red eyes stared straight through him as it came towards him at a dead run. With a mental command that he'd kept firmly in the front of his mind, the Phoenix tracked the synth with her rear cannons and opened up. The effect wasn't exactly what he had in mind. The first shot seemed to blast the battle synth sideways, but the four subsequent shots not only blasted a section of his hangar door to shreds, they blew both battle synths inside the building.
"Stupid, stupid, stupid," Jason huffed,
sprinting over the pad and approaching the door with reckless abandon. He'd barely cleared the gaping maw in the door when his plasma rifle was neatly plucked from his hands and an open palm slammed into his chest. The blow was vicious, but since he was still alive, he had to assume it wasn't a full-strength hit. He landed hard and was trying to catch his breath while drawing his sidearms when both battle synths walked back out of the opening and approached him.
"That's enough," a voice boomed across the landing pad.
499-302, stand down, immediately.
Both battle synths assumed a non-threatening posture and stood down from full combat mode. Jason watched as the eyes faded to their normal glossy onyx and their armament retracted back under their arm fairings.
"We'd hoped to do this clandestinely, Captain, but as usual, you have made my job so much more difficult," the voice continued.
"That's sort of my thing," Jason groaned, rolling up into a sitting position and looking around.
He couldn't see who had been speaking to him, but it sounded like it was coming from under the Phoenix.
If you wouldn't mind telling your ship to stop aiming its cannons at my associates?
Jason shrugged and sent the command to retract the weaponry and put the Phoenix in a passive surveillance mode. With Crusher not there, he had little hope of defeating two battle synths now that he'd given up the element of surprise and had already been disarmed.
That's better. My name is Alokur.
Jason turned and saw a well-built Prue coming out from around one of the Phoenix's main landing gear struts.
Oh, hell, you already know who I am,
Jason said, standing up slowly while keeping a wary eye on the two battle synths who were staring at him impassively.
So, Alokur, do I really even need to guess what a Prue is doing here with two battle synths poking around my base?
I think you know why we're here, Alokur said. If you'd be so kind as to invite me in, we can discuss this civilly and hopefully come to some sort of understanding.
Just one question before that. Who do you represent?
Caprian Intelligence.
Figures, Jason said, watching as a swarm of little black drones detached themselves from the Phoenix's sensors and flew off into the night.
Chapter 7
Caprian Intelligence, eh? Twingo asked.
Jason had roused the rest of the crew, tried unsuccessfully to call Crusher and wake him up, and then called Mach to let him know what was happening. The last one had been with some reluctance, but in the end, Mach's perspective on what Alokur might say could be useful. As a concession, the Caprian operative agreed to leave his battle synth muscle outside the ravaged doors with instructions to let Mach through when he arrived.
That's right, Alokur said.
He sipped tentatively at the cup of coffee Twingo had put in front of him, and then nodded at the engineer with a half-smile.
Not bad.
Mach must not have been asleep, because he arrived less than 30 minutes after Jason had made contact, rushing through the rip in the doors and wearing the same expensive suit he'd had on when they last saw him. When Alokur saw him, the shock and recognition on his face were easy for Jason to read now that he'd had some exposure to Pruvian body language.
What are you doing here? Mach blurted out when he saw the Prue sitting at the table.
I might ask you the same question, Saditava Mach.
Alokur said the name mockingly, and now Jason's interest was piqued.
I'm helping my associates with a delicate matter, Mach said. Are you here at the behest of the Caprian government?
So he's really an intelligence operative, Jason interrupted.
He is, Mach confirmed. Quite a high-ranking one. Far too high to be out here along the edge of the expanse chasing down petty matters that
I'd hardly call the theft of a prototype battle synth body to be petty, Mach,
Alokur said.
Yes, I'm here representing Capri, but not because they asked me to. It's complicated.
Uncomplicated, Jason said.
Alokur looked around the table and then gave the Pruvian equivalent of a shrug and motioned to Twingo for more coffee.
Some years ago, my office was tasked with tracking down rumors that some faction within the Ministry of Martial Affairs was secretly trying to reactivate the Battle Synth program, he began without preamble. More specifically, we'd heard credible rumors that they were trying to produce an even more powerful, capable combat unit. I was given a surprising amount of freedom and resources to accomplish my task, including 4 battle synths and a 12-person technical staff that had been part of the original battle synth project. We quietly poked around the edges of clandestine operations, trying to see who might be brazen and foolish enough to violate interstellar treaties. It wasn't until your group rained chaos upon my planet, freed a group of untethered battle synths, escaped with that group, and destroyed a military facility that we began to see movement from the key players. Apparently, you disrupted their timetable and spooked them enough to make a few critical mistakes.
You're welcome, Jason said modestly.
Soon after, we began to get intel from our field units of a team that seemed to be doing recon on the same facilities we were.
Alokur ignored Jason's comment.
The second time they showed up at a place we had under surveillance, I went personally to see who it could be.
Imagine my surprise when it was none other than the Merc unit that had wreaked havoc on Khepri and absconded with Lot 700 before the dust had even settled. We then began concentrating on you and started digging into your past exploits. Criminals though you all are, you do seem to hold to a certain pattern. Whatever your interest was in the revamped Battle Synth program, I was confident that you weren't trying to steal it for another government or for a criminal enterprise. We also noticed right away that not all of you were involved and that the group's leadership was missing.
You knew that we had a Battle Synth in our crew at one time, right? Jason asked.
Yes. Combat Unit 777, known as Lucky, once he began to work as a member of your crew,
Alokur said.
There's a lot about that situation that doesn't make sense to me. Would it be possible for me to speak to Lucky?
He didn't make it through the Khepri operation, Twingo said, while everyone else just looked uncomfortable. At least, not wholly intact.
Alokur narrowed his eyes for a moment, looked at Tallis, and then back at Twingo, and his eyes widened in understanding.
I had it all wrong.
Remarkable, he whispered.
You weren't looking for a weapons program. You were looking for a way to save your friend.
Before any of them could answer, he pressed ahead with his story. For some reason, it seemed your team had better intel than we'd been able to gather on potential lab sites, so we decided to simplify our procedures and began tracking you, letting your group do all the hard work.
So when you jumped us in the lab and stole one of the bodies?
Twingo left the question dangling.
Correct. We didn't attack you because we'd deemed you to not be a threat. We took one of the bodies to provide incontrovertible evidence to ministry leadership along with a data dump from the servers, rigged the place to blow, and got off the planet before the local authorities could react. I take it you were successful in stealing one of the prototypes as well?
Yes, Jason said, not seeing any reason to lie when the evidence was sitting on the hangar floor below them. I take it you're here to reclaim it?
This is where the story gets complicated, as I mentioned, Alokur said. While it's not been widely known, there's been an internal shakeup on Khepri.
On all the Pillar Worlds, actually.
How big a shakeup? Mok asked.
You could almost call it a coup.
What?
You really don't know, do you? Alokur looked at Mok speculatively. I'd suggest you verify what I'm telling you with your contacts within Imperial Intelligence. I'm sure they're tracking this closely. Apparently, there's a new faction within the Confed Council that has moved quickly to solidify power and is now restructuring the entire organization.
The Confed is all but dead, Jason scoffed.
That's where you couldn't be more wrong, Alokur said. They were wounded when the central banking system folded after our AI was destroyed. But they already have a new one, ready to come online, and the fleet isn't any less powerful than it was a year ago. The decisions coming out of the Council right now might not make a lot of sense, but this new faction is able to get everyone moving in the same direction in a way that no other controlling party has been able to.
What's this have to do with Khepri? Tallis asked.
Our home is a pillar world. In the past, not much of an issue was made of the old treaties, but this new council is reminding everyone just who is in charge. Khepri was able to act with autonomy thanks to being the world that controlled most of the Confed's economic power, but that's no longer true. As you'd expect, our planet's leadership folded almost immediately from the slightest threat of force from the council. They all sat in silence a moment, considering the various implications of a power grab within the Confed hierarchy. For as long as anyone could remember, the Confed was little more than a scheme where star systems paid an exorbitant amount for the dubious protection of the fleet, while the core worlds enjoyed the spoils. The whole thing reminded Jason of how the Mafia worked back on Earth. It was a crap system, but the alternatives were bleak. One could entreat some of the other major powers in the area, but without some significant resource, the Sabra Protectorate wouldn't even entertain an offer,
and the Asquarian Empire was just a touch on the side of being xenophobic to the point they didn't like dealing with anyone outside the Concordian cluster. The Crydal Cooperative was a promising upstart, but they were small and could offer little in the way of real protection. The reality for most small systems was that if they wanted to not be viewed as prey, they needed to accept the Confed's terms. From what Alokar was telling them, something had drastically changed in the wake of the recent economic upheaval. If the Confed went from being basically a protection racket that paid lip service to the independence of its citizens to something truly sinister in its quest for power, they were all in for a bumpy ride. Under its current charter, the Confed Starfleet was spread thin and used more for policing actions and projecting influence. But if new management decided it wanted to use the full might of its military to bring member systems to heel, Jason could only shake his head at the potentially horrific new scenario they were looking at. "So, why are you here?" Jason asked after a long moment. "I can't trust anyone in my chain of command right now," Alokar said. "Given the political climate on Khepri, I'm afraid that if I were to hand over what we found, all I would be doing was handing the Confed a new weapon to abuse. With the old treaties now in question, it's not outside the realm of possibility to think that the production of these new battle synths would not only be encouraged, but funded by the Council itself. As for the exact reason I'm here, since you also have one of the new prototypes, I had to determine what your intentions were."
"And?" Jason pressed.
"I'm convinced you're not working for the Council or any other factions to gain access to a weapon system. But there are still issues with letting you keep it,"
Alokar said carefully.
"Perhaps we can discuss this further after you've all had time to process what I've told you."
"Jason, I'd like to return to my ship and get some independent confirmation on things from my sources."
Mach made it sound like a request.
"I don't give a shit," Jason shrugged.
"You're not a prisoner here. I wouldn't mind hearing what you find out, however."
"Of course," Mach said, rising.
He looked out over the mezzanine's railing down to the hangar floor and frowned.
"That's odd."
Jason stood and peered over the rail and saw that both battle synths that had come with Alokar were kneeling in front of the stasis pod, not moving at all.
"What the hell?"
"Are the remains of combat unit... forgive me. Are the remains of Lucky inside that stasis chamber?" Alokar asked.
"They are," Twingo said.
"Leave them be, please," Alokar said. "They're paying their respects. Lucky's exploits have circulated through the ranks of the remaining battle synths. From what I understand, he's something of a folk hero to them."
"His own lot mates didn't see it that way," Jason muttered, drawing a curious look from the Keprian spy. "They're welcome to stay as long as they wish. How the hell did they know he was in there?"
"They probably heard everything we said from the hole in the door," Twingo said. "You remember what it was like trying to sneak a word past Lucky. He could hear through bulkheads on a ship underway."
"Thank you, Captain," Alokar said. "I don't pretend to understand their culture or ways, but I've come to realize they're much more complicated than the Ministry would have the public believe."
"You have no idea," Cage laughed.
"What the hell happened here?"
"Why don't you check the 36 messages I left you?" Jason snapped.
"Oh, I turned my comm off so I could get some sleep," Crusher said, digging around in his pockets. "You only left 9 messages. I feel like you're being overly dramatic. Perhaps if you..." "Oh, shit!"
"They're with us," Jason shouted when he realized Crusher was reacting to the still kneeling battle synths near the closed stasis pod.
"I feel like I missed a lot."
"Check your damn messages."
"Captain, a word?" Alokar seemed to materialize from the shadows near the hole in the door. Jason motioned for the crew to follow him over to the smaller of 2 open-air lifts that ran from the floor up to the mezzanine level.
"What's on your mind?" Jason asked, after handing a steaming mug of his own brand of coffee to the eager crew.
He made a mental note to check and make sure Rocky Mountain Coffee was opening up to the Khepri market. Judging by Alokur's reaction, the stringent drink would be a hit.
It seems to me that you don't have everything you need to try and attempt something as ambitious as transferring your friend into that new body.
I assumed you were going to tell me we had to destroy the prototype.
Jason.